Howdy do, buckaroos. Welcome to the Mac Observer's Daily Observations Podcast. It is Monday, May 13th, 2019. I am your host, Kelly Gamont. With me today, I have John Martellaro. Hi, John.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
I'm glad to have you with us. Also with me today, I have Brian Chaffin. Hi, Brian.
I am good. Thanks for asking. I've just been singing songs about Brett Kavanaugh.
Okay. So what I wanted to start with to talk to both of you this morning is we have some news fresh today, hot off the presses, as they used to say, about a Supreme Court ruling. And Brian, you jumped on this and read through the whole thing. So I'd like to find out if you can tell us a little bit about what happened.
I thought we were starting with the other one.
Well,
fair enough, right? You're the host. I will obey. Right. So the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, ruled on a consumer case arguing that Apple's App Store was a monopoly and that Apple could be sued for an antitrust violation for having the App Store and for forcing consumers to buy apps from the App Store. The ruling that was handed down today was not on the merits of the case one way or the other. It was instead on whether or not the plaintiffs had the right to sue, which is something that is sometimes challenged, and seldom actually makes it all the way up to the Supreme Court, but does occasionally.
Okay.
So the four liberal justices joined with newcomer conservative Brett Kavanaugh, who wrote the decision that was signed on to by the four liberal justices. And we've got a quote from him that is, this is from the ruling that he wrote. It was a 14-page ruling. If accepted, Apple's theory would provide a roadmap for monopolistic retailers to structure transactions with manufacturers or suppliers so as to evade antitrust claims by consumers and thereby thwart effective antitrust enforcement, by which I call balderdash.
So my question about this is that when I was reading through this, it wasn't clear to me if what they're unhappy about is the only place you can buy apps is the App Store, or if it's Apple's 30%. Because like, if Apple basically didn't charge in, if Apple wasn't taking a cut of what people paid in the App Store, then would this be antitrust or no? I mean, would this be a valid case to continue? Is what
well,
I'm
it's not a valid case of antitrust because Apple doesn't even have monopoly power in the smartphone market, let alone monopoly market share. So one way or another, it's not anti. I mean, it's just not antitrust. It's just so freaking ridiculous. But what they're arguing is that because Apple takes a 30% cut, and because Apple requires all apps to go through the App Store, therefore, consumers are paying more because apparently free and 99 cents is more.
So that was the thing I think that was confusing to me, because I wasn't sure what it was that they were claiming antitrust over. And it sounds like this might just be a case of poor branding because it's not really antitrust.
I would love to know. Okay, right. Can I put on my? I don't normally endorse conspiracy theories, and I don't have any evidence for this, but I'd like to put on my particular conspiracy hat on this particular one.
All right, as long as it matches your shoes, go ahead.
I would like to know who's actually behind this, because removing the App Store requirement for iOS would make iOS significantly less secure. Mm-hmm. It would make consumers significantly less safe. Mm-hmm. It would make Apple, let me rephrase it, it would make Apple users significantly less safe as a whole. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't do much for prices because, after all, the App Store actually caused the rush to the bottom in the first place.
Right.
It's actually the App Store cut that resulted in the market having no support because there was always a developer willing to go cheaper. So, I mean, like I want to know who's behind this case and why they are behind this case, because their arguments are on the only go surface deep before you run into problems. And if they end up winning, we Apple consumers will be significantly less freaking safe. Mm-hmm. And that bothers me.
And the thing about that initially that I think of is look at some of the security issues we have already. Right. And if you think we don't have any, go back to the Mac Observer Daily Observations podcast page. Look for any episode that has Andrew on it and listen to what we have Andrew talk about. Because most of the time, it's some sort of security issue. And so that's a thing that worries me, is because people don't necessarily have that kind of awareness otherwise. And there is a certain bar that has to be met by the App Store. And one of the things I was thinking about with this, if it was, you know, was the part where it said that developers get to set prices. Like, that's true. I mean, yes, they have to end in 99 cents, right? But it's up to you if the first half of that number is a 1 or a 100 or anything in between.
Well, that's what Apple argued. That's what Apple argued, and that's what Brett Kavanaugh was and essentially the liberal minority that signed on with him were saying, is that argument is not an argument.
Mm-hmm. Which I wonder about, because before there was an iOS app store, and even, you know, today you can buy Apple software for a Mac from loads of places. It doesn't have to be the Mac App Store. Yeah. And you can buy
because Apple hasn't been able to enforce that yet, but go ahead.
Well, that's true. But in the, like, even before there was a Mac App Store, right? So in that stretch of time, like, you could still go buy stuff and people were allowed to make that whatever they wanted. And I feel like having a concentrated area where all of that stuff is, like you were saying, like, that's where the race to the bottom happened, because nobody was selling apps for a dollar before the Mac App Store, because you could charge whatever you wanted. So
this lawsuit, I want to stipulate, is over the iOS App Store.
Over iOS, right. I'm trying to draw a parallel between the two. That's all it was. Because it is a thing that we used to do that was fine. And so I'm interested to see where this goes. And part of the reason I'm interested to see where this goes is because Apple's not the only company that makes a phone and also puts an App Store on that phone and gets a cut of what people buy in that App Store.
Yeah, but with the Google Play Store, while you can put stuff on Google Play, and while Google does take a cut, you can also buy from other places, which is one reason why the Android platform is riddled with malware. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the reports of when the Chinese government in Hong Kong was using jailbroken apps to basically spy on and track protesters in Hong Kong, and there have been other instances like that where jailbroken app stores were being used to distribute malware. I mean, like, I get if you don't want to be in Apple's walled garden. Mm-hmm. But my suggestion is that you go to the other platform.
Yeah.
Well, that brings up the parallel question. Do Apple customers have a right to infect their phones and to download software from wherever they please?
They probably do. Legal, yeah. Right? They probably do. They don't, actually. Right now they don't. And that's what this lawsuit could.
Well, they don't have the capability right now, but do they have the legal right? Is Apple restricting iOS customers from going to the party who develops the software directly and downloading it, even though they may risk an infection, malware, terrible things happening? Do they have a legal right to do that if they want to? And does Apple have the right to stop them from doing that for the sake of security?
if the thing is that if, I mean, like, if that's the route that this case ends up taking us, it is at best an exercise of mutilating our face to spider face.
I know, I know. But I fear that the right of people to do something that they want to do with aware of the consequences somehow is going to have a legal status that's greater than Apple's right to restrict us from doing harm.
Well,
I just fear that.
The thing I wonder about is,
I get that.
Aren't you, and maybe, I don't know if this is the problem, but aren't you knowingly entering into that arrangement when you buy an iPhone? Like, I know the only place I'm supposed to get apps from is Apple's App Store.
Fair, you know that. So, there's probably a lot of consumers who don't. But
does this mean we're going to get another paragraph on the box or something? Like, you know, when you open this, part of the terms is like you can only get apps from the iOS App Store or something. I don't know. That's where I'm interested in as far as like outcome to see where this heads, because it seems like there's a lot of ways that this could go since it's going to proceed, and you know, it could just get dismissed. That's an option. And I'm wondering where that's going to end up. So,
well, it won't be dismissed at this point. It'll probably be tried on the merits of the argument.
Okay.
And who knows where that's going to go?
Yeah, that's true. That's part of the question. As that develops, we will definitely talk to you about it. Right now, I want to make sure that we talk about the other thing we had to talk about today, and that is Apple Retail, sort of. Not necessarily how many customers or anything like that, but the retail experience itself. And John, this was something that you wrote about last week in Particle Debris.
Yeah, it was the Particle Debris article of the week. It was by Mark Gurman and Matthew Townsend at Bloomberg, How the Apple Store Lost Its Luster. And there are several examples given of people who are having difficulties in the Apple stores, not being able to get somebody to pay attention to them, to take their money, to sit down with them one-on-one, that the Apple stores under Angela Ahrens were focused a lot on branding, on the atmosphere of the situation, and got away from the nuts and bolts of just good old-fashioned customer service. Here, let's sit down, let me fix that for you, it's a genius bar, and so on. And in my own case, I had to weigh it against my personal experience. I've always had good success at the Apple stores in Denver. But a friend of ours went to an Apple store in Albuquerque and tried to buy an Apple Watch visiting her sister. And they wouldn't let her touch the Apple Watches. They wouldn't let her try one on. They wouldn't let her handle it. And she was very annoyed. And she came back to Denver and told us about it. And she went into an Apple store in Denver and she said, I want to buy an Apple Watch. Help me out. And they said, sure. What do you want to do? And she said, I want to try one on. I want to look at the colors. I want to see how it feels. Show me how to use it. And they said, sure. And they sat down with her, and she walked out of the store with an Apple Watch. Mm-hmm. So, as I said in Particle Debris, it can vary a lot by geography, by store manager philosophy. But Mark Gurman makes a good case about the Apple stores working more on atmosphere and branding and then getting away from good old-fashioned customer service and one-on-one with the customers. And that has to be weighed against, you know, the ever-increasing demands for revenue. Apple's into services, and Apple wants to see store revenue continue to climb. But nothing goes up forever, as we know from the iPhone sales. Mm-hmm. You can't just force the stores to have ever-increasing revenue, because ever-increasing revenue from the stores, despite increasing population and increasing number of stores, a demand for more revenue per store means an ever-increasing compromise on customer service, in my mind. And apparently, Apple's reached that limit.
So one thing that I noticed in this article, they were talking about, one of the things was just sort of wandering around and not being able to find anybody when you wanted to buy something. And
oh, I don't understand that, because there's always a concierge with the iPad at the front door.
Right. And that was one thing that I was thinking about was at the two Apple stores that I go to regularly here in the Portland area, you cannot be in the store without a concierge at least checking with you. And if it's, yeah, I just want to look, they'll leave you alone. It's a very brief interaction with somebody, but you always end up interacting with somebody. And you sort of can't get around that the way that the stores here are set up. So it's a very, to me, it was sort of a surprising experience that somebody sort of wandered around going like, I just want to pay, and couldn't find anyone to help them take care of that. So to me, that was very odd, because here you get navigated where it is you need to go, whether it's like stand over there and someone will help you, or if you go over to, you know, the thing you want to look at or whatever.
I think more importantly, it's anecdotal.
Yeah, I think that's
anecdotal. It's not necessarily systematic.
Right.
And it's hard for me to offer an opinion of the state of Apple stores everywhere, because I am living, I don't know, I live like 7 miles at the most, 5 miles away from Apple Park. And the Apple store that I tend to frequent is in Valley Fair Mall, which is 3 miles away from Apple Park and from Infinite Loop. So, you know, like, I would imagine that people are probably a little more on their toes here.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, anecdotal evidence about what's happening in an app store, be it good or bad, is meaningless. Mm-hmm. What really matters is the system. And I don't know that the system is broken. I very much agree with John that it may be bending, but it's certainly not broken.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
I think part of it for me in reading this and looking at it and everything was it does sound like it's meant to be that one of the things Angela Aaron set out to do is make Apple retail stores a better experience, not necessarily a better retail experience, because it's not clear when you walk in and want to buy something, it's not clear without a concierge what you're supposed to do. Right. Like you have they set you up with somebody so that you can buy the thing. And then the person, you know, goes in the back and gets the thing. And then, you know, you Apple Pay for it or whatever. And you fill out your stuff and then you leave. So it seems like if I told them I was just looking and I was just looking and then I decided I wanted to buy a thing, how does the process go from there? And it doesn't seem like that has improved. That's almost sort of gotten worse because there's not a clear cut retail area because there's no registers in Apple stores. So
yeah, but there haven't been for like 12 right. years.
Right. But there used to be, at least here, it seemed like there was an area where you went where there was always somebody who was there to help you ring up. Right. And then
I wrote an article a couple months ago about a very experienced retail analyst who said that long ago, the car dealerships recognized the value of having the showroom disconnected from the sale, from the service department. Mm-hmm. And Apple doesn't do that. And his opinion was that eventually Apple would have to do that.
Well, right now it seems like they have. And the big building or the big, you know, giant store location with the Apple logo on it is service. And sales is something that's supposed to happen someplace else.
Well, one of the complaints about the Apple stores now is that the Genius Bar is gone and that there's a crowded workroom in the back. Used to be you could sit at the Genius Bar and the Genius would talk to you and show you what it was doing with your computer and could actually mm-hmm. fix it on the table on the spot. And now you have to make arrangements ahead of time, make an appointment. You hand them over your phone. They go into the back room. They tell you when it's going to be done or you have to come back later. And it's very disconnected.
Well, the last time I took my Mac in, which was last November, I think, October, November of last year, I had to take my Mac in, and my laptop. And the experience I had was exactly the one that you described, which was I sat at the table. I talked to the Genius. And I did have to make an appointment, but I went down there and I talked to the Genius and he told me what he was doing and I got to ask a bunch of questions and he answered all my questions. And anyone who's ever hung out with me knows I had many, many questions and told me what was going to happen. And then one thing and another, just like I expect a Genius Bar experience to be. The last time I went in for my phone, it was the experience you described where like it just got, they said, oh, this is what's happening. They whisked it off into the back room and then, you know, it'll be done in an hour or whatever. So I don't know why those things have to be so different, but it's kind of odd. it's odd that people are expecting the same experience for everything, but I don't know that there's necessarily the same experience for everything. Because, like, if it's a screen replacement, for example, you kind of want to do that in a more controlled area than a retail floor, I would think. You know, a little bit of concentration, a little less dust, that might be a plus. So I totally get having to do stuff like that in a place where customers can't necessarily see you. That seemed like I have no issue with that. That doesn't seem odd to me. Brian, how about you?
One of the things before Brian cuts in, one of the things that I wanted to point out was, is that the training has changed. It used to be, according to Mark Gurman anyway, that you flew to California and you got a couple weeks of training on campus and you really felt part of the company. Now the training's done in the stores. And that the consensus was is that the employees weren't as well trained as they used to be. That was the affirmation that was made in the article.
I love Mark Gurman. I love me some Mark Gurman, just loves me some Mark Gurman. But it's not sustainable to bring all retail employees to Cupertino. That's just not even vaguely sustainable. And it's probably not even vaguely efficient. I mean, retail training should probably be taking place in the stores. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that it is as good as training at Apple. And I agree that that it's got to make employees feel a little bit more like part of the company to be able to go to Cupertino. But just Apple has a crap ton of stores. And they're all over the place. And putting people up in hotels and all that sort of thing is expensive.
Yeah, because they just don't have enough money, you know.
Well, no, they have plenty of money.
Money's so tight at Apple.
They have plenty of money. I'm the last person who's going to argue that Apple can't afford to do something, but I don't even think it makes sense to do it in this particular case.
It's partly scale and it's partly the nature of retail. Like, lots of people are only there. You know, there's a lot of turnover in retail. You know, a year or less is common in certain retail jobs, and I wonder if that's part of it, is not that they don't have the money, John, but that it wasn't a smart investment of that money to fly someone out to Cupertino, put them up for 2 weeks, give them all the training, send them back and have them leave in 6 months because it turns out they really wanted to work at Banana Republic instead.
Oh, that's nickel and diamond. I mean, thinking.
No, but I wonder if the reason they stopped doing it was...
I mean, that applies to corporate America. I mean, millions of people in corporate America obtain training every year.
Right, but they don't all have to go to the same place at the same time in order to make that happen. And I think maybe the bottleneck was just...
If you stop training people, then you're not wasting money because they might leave tomorrow.
That's not what I'm saying.
Well, that's what you did say.
That's not what I said, John. Scroll back your memory bank and play it back. That's not what I said.
Why spend all that money? It's not a good investment because they might leave in 6 months. That's unquote.
John is probably right with what you were implying, whether or not you intended to imply it. One way or another, though, I don't think you can make a solid argument that retail employees should be flown to Cupertino for 2 weeks of training.
No.
That to me is not. It's hard to see where that really pays for itself over the.
Exactly.
Well, I agree that it was a good idea to begin with, and I agree that.
Yeah, I agree.
As Apple grows, it's becoming more and more impractical.
Yeah, and how long have they not been doing that? I mean, like.
Oh, I don't know.
A really long time.
I've never met an Apple employee who wasn't well-trained, though. You know, I talk to a lot of Apple employees, and I've never met one who said, gee, I don't know the answer to that. I'll have to go talk to my supervisor. Never.
I have gotten that, but I was also asking something really weird.
I'm not surprised.
By and large, my again, anecdotal evidence really doesn't matter anything in this particular conversation, but I agree that every Apple employee that I've interacted with has been just awesome.
Yeah, same here.
Yeah, I have gotten, like, I don't know, as an answer on some different things. Partly it was, you know, what happened to my computer? Is it going to be okay? But by and large, like, it does seem like they're pretty on top of things. It's mostly, like, I understand what they're saying, what is being discussed in the article. But like Brian said, a lot of this sounds more anecdotal than it does necessarily systemic. And that's a different problem to have to try and solve, right? Like, if the store in Albuquerque isn't letting anybody get their hands on an Apple Watch, and the whole way the whole Apple Watch thing worked was you come to the store to touch them and try them on and get a look at all the colors of the bands and the sizes and whatever, but you can't actually buy one here. You just have to do that online and have it sent to you. Like, that was the initial watch.
Can I wrap this up here?
Yeah, that was the initial watch thing, which I think is an odd experience, but it definitely warrants discussion. Go ahead.
Let me wrap this up. People who think that the Apple stores have changed for the worse are going to say this article is exactly spot on. I'm looking at you, John Keat. And people who have a good experience with Apple stores are going to say this article is full of crap. And the reality is that there's probably truth in both of those.
I agree.
There have been some.
What Brian said.
Yes, I think so too. Whether or not you're John Keat and you would like to give us feedback, you can do so at, hi John, you can do so at observations@macobserver.com. You can catch us at TMO Daily on Twitter, and you can leave a comment in the show notes. Thanks so much for joining me today, both of you. John, thanks for coming by.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Brian, thanks so much for being here.
Yep. Thanks for having us. Good to be here. Good times. Yay.
I've been your host, Kelly Gamont. I will talk to all of you tomorrow. In the meantime, be excellent to each other.